Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed Sponsored Jobs. With Indeed Sponsored Jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed Sponsored Jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
I am really lucky, and I'm actually quite excited to sit here today and talk to Jerry Noonan. And why don't you introduce what you did over your quite large career in construction?
Well, it's pretty normal, really, but I suppose I started on a farm in the Mallee up at a place called Nullarwool. And having read my book, you know where that is.
I do.
And then I was the third of three boys, and I'd family of nine. There was four older than me and four younger. Two boys older than me went on the farm, and I was sat down when I was 14 doing intermediate, as it was called then. It's probably year 10 by today's standards, which is all you could do in the Mallee at the schools, and told that there's not going to be any land for you. You're going to have to go off and to school and study. So in those days, you did what your parents told you. We weren't all smart asses like the kids of today and didn't have the advantage of knowledge, because all we knew was a newspaper and a radio, or wireless we called it. The war was paramount up till I was 10, and then the rest of the world were just on a wheat and sheep farm, very simple. And I went, Mum and Dad took me down to Bendigo to the School of Mines, because I was always like playing around with mechanical things and fixing ploughs and tractors and headers and things. And I had fairly good marks in my intermediate, particularly in mathematics and sciences and things, which I enjoyed. And they said, oh, you should do engineering. So I went and did engineering. So it was a four-year diploma course, it was called.
Geotechnical engineering?
No, it was in mechanical engineering.
Mechanical engineering.
At the Bendigo School of Mines, they had civil, mechanical and electrical engineering. They did surveying, they did chemistry, they did metallurgy, because the School of Mines obviously was established in the 1850s to service the mining industry, and Bendigo and Ballarat had one as well. The RMIT did the same course, as did the Gordon Institute in Geelong, and there was a couple of other tech schools around that did this diploma course. On the completion of the diploma course, if you wished to, you got an exemption from the first 2 years of doing engineering or metallurgy or anything at the Melbourne University. There was only one university in Victoria in those days, which was Melbourne. So you could go on and do the final 2 years and get a degree. About 30% of the kids did that. I didn't, because I thought, I've done enough study, I'll get out and get the hands dirty. So I got a job with CSIRO, saw mechanics section. Now everyone would know who CSIRO are. And they had recently established a saw mechanics section, and saw mechanics itself as a division of civil engineering really emerged in the war, primarily for the building of airstrips quickly and economically in under emergency conditions through Europe, obviously, and America to a lesser extent. And in Australia, strangely enough, because when the Japs entered the war, we built a lot of airstrips on the road north south of Darwin, just immediately alongside the highway for emergency stuff, and they were used because Darwin was bombed, as you probably know. So saw mechanics was starting to emerge, and I joined this weird outfit called Saw Mechanics, and my schoolmates who went on to do other engineering things, mainly came to a lot of us came to Melbourne because there was not many jobs in the country. And they all reckoned that saw mechanics were blokes who worked in underground garages, so that was as knowledgeable as we were. But it was an interesting career. I had a good boss who just come back from England with a PhD in this newfangled, he was an Australian who got a scholarship to go to London and get a PhD in soil mechanics, which is this newfangled science. And we, it meant drilling holes, taking soil samples and designing for roads, for road pavements, for airstrips, for building foundations, for dams and for all structures, because everything's built on ground pretty much.
Of course.
Except
now,
for
the
aeroplanes.
Part that I can't wait for is when you tell everyone what the name of your company that ended up building was, where they've all listened along and gone, oh, guy from the Mallee came down, mining university, and then went down, and then you're going to say, and the company that I started was, well, actually it went through a few generations of names because I've read your book. But what was your company that you started and built for 50 years?
Well, when I worked for 3 years for CSIRO, and then my boss at the time was a bloke called Dick Parry, who was headhunted, as the term is today. That term didn't exist in our vocabulary then. But an English company called Foundation Engineering, which was one of the new companies in England, and there's some new ones in America, obviously, and presumably in France and Germany and those places too, but I was not aware of them. And I wasn't even aware of any soil mechanics companies because it was a new name to me.
It didn't even exist.
So this English company called Foundation Engineering set up in 1960 and headhunted Parry to head it. And I had worked with him at CSIRO for 3 years and he asked me to come and work with him, which we did. That company then prospered. In 65, Parry was offered the Professor of Civil Engineering at Cambridge University, which for an engineer is like dying and going to heaven, as I'm sure you'd understand. Well, you may laugh, but they were significant events.
My mate
still is a bit of a significant event.
Yeah, my mate has a company and he grew up wanting to build bridges. And so when he finally got the head engineer job at building a bridge, he couldn't walk around without knocking things off of the table. He was that full of blood, you know.
Yeah.
So it's... I understand the Cambridge thing, like just absolute ecstasy.
Absolute. So he remained his whole life there, and he died 18 months ago in Cambridge. So he spent the rest of his life there. And then when he left in mid-60s, I was given the title of manager of Foundation Engineering in Australia. I became the manager of the Australian section of the English company. And in 1972... I was very frustrated with what we could do because you had to, if you wanted to buy a new pencil sharpener, you had to send a requisition to head office in England to get that, almost. This is the way it worked. And in those days there was no emails, which you young people probably can't even understand. You'd write a letter and you'd post a letter and 3 months later you'd get a response.
And you're allowed to buy a pencil sharpener then.
By then you didn't need one. They'd biros probably. But... sounds to you
it's ridiculous,
hard to believe, but it's pretty real. So we I was frustrated and when they'd visit quite regularly, you know, once a year-ish, maybe once every 2 years, there were colonels that were running Foundation Engineering in England, and we had to call them colonels. Well, you can imagine a Mallee grown up kid calling a Pommy aristocratic sort of person, a colonel, was a bit against the grain. So I never really said, and they kept telling me, I remember on one occasion they took us out to dinner at Florentino, my wife and I and a couple of other Australians and then these aristocratic English colonels, and we were very newly married at this stage, and after the going to Florentino, which for us was like ducks out of water. We would never graced Florentino before or since. We were generally eating at the cheapest pub up the corner, unless we were cooking it ourselves. But the two of the colonels, or these two colonels, sort of cornered my wife. We were standing out in Bourke Street after having a dinner, and I was talking to a couple of the other blokes. And we're driving home and my wife tells me... that I'm not going to do any good in the company because I didn't respect the English colonels. And I was told that I had no future in this, through my wife, that I had no future in the company. So that was okay. So then this communication thing was a hell of a problem. And sure, you could ring them up, but you'd never get the bloke on the other end of the phone, and communications were very, very basic in those days. So I convinced them to sell me the company, but they wouldn't sell me the name because they used that in all over the world, and that was understandable. So at that time in life, the Saw Mechanics started to get its own name of Geotechnical Engineering. It was just happening, and I grabbed that and registered it and called the company that. So that's how that happened in 1972.
Commonly known now as Geotech.
Geotech. Well, everyone calls it Geotech because it's the name that...
is synonymous all with people, everything.
Well, everybody abbreviates words, the Australians particularly, but the POMs do too.
Yep.
And so forth. So that happened. This was a stroke of absolute luck that happens in life. That happened in September 72. And in December the 13th, 1972, do you know what happened in Australia? Probably the most momentous thing that ever happened in my life.
In 72?
Correct.
Is that the Westgate Bridge?
No.
Damn. I was so close because it's on my brain because I want to make sure I bring it up.
That was 1970-ish, I reckon.
Damn it. Yeah. I was close. I was thinking what happened in Australia in 1972. So if it's momentous, it's got to be government related then.
Yeah.
Yep. But there was no wars on.
No big wars.
No big wars at the time.
There was a war, but we won't go into that one.
Yeah. Okay, you're gonna have to.
Gough
Whitlam came in. Yep. Okay.
Now you were not born then, were you? No.
No. 1986.
But you've read enough history and you're living it now. In 1972, Whitlam came in December the 13th, and the Labor Party. We had had a Liberal government for probably the previous 12 or 15 years.
Yes.
And the Labor government got in, and things went crazy. And we borrowed a lot of money and mortgaged everything we had, plus things we didn't even have, because the truth never worried me greatly. If I could manoeuvre a deal, I'd manoeuvre a deal. And we bought the company, and in December 72, Whitlam came in, and probably by about March 73, the world went berserk. The building industry went mad. We were doing basement excavation and providing this ground support through ground anchors and piling and all that sort of thing. And we made so much bloody money, you wouldn't call the king your uncle in those days. But inflation went mad in those days. And we had $2 million in the Commonwealth Bank at 18% interest at call. Now, you can't believe that, but that's true.
18%?
At call. Not at fixed deposit for any months. It was mad. So we made a lot of money, but it was, well, we had to pay back our debts we raised to buy the thing in this inflated money, so we really got given the company for nothing, as it turned out, but that was pure us. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, but the luck is a funny thing. Luck is described as, you know, it makes it sound like it's all just a coincidence, but you'd worked there for so long. You'd got yourself into a financial position where you could leverage against something. Luck isn't just luck.
Oh, yes, but that was a lot of luck.
There's part of it.
If it had have gone normal, we probably would have taken 10 years to pay off those debts, or five anyway. Mm. But we paid it off in half a year.
Yeah.
It was bizarre. but the inflation dollar, we had 10 inflation dollars to an ordinary dollar in about 2 years' time or something. It was ridiculous.
Yeah.
Wages went up in 2 years, the wages went up three times.
In two years?
Getting $60 a week, our blokes, to getting $200 a week in 3 years. Shit. In 2 years. It was mad. You read a bit of that, and maybe in my book there's some of that.
There's a little bit, but you gloss over. Like, for the last couple of days I've been banging through your book pretty fast to see if there's anything, which is why I bring up the Westgate.
You look at wage go, right, you Google it all because you blokes know how to do all that. If you can't do it, this young fella will.
Yeah, if I can.
But it was quite bizarre, really. So we were well established anyway because we're the first player of the market. By this time there's quite a few other players in the market, mm-hmm. in the geotech science. But we had the start, so we're well established.
You went far and wide, first off, and you had a lot of contacts and contracts all over Australia.
Yeah, you had to
And New Zealand. You went over to New Zealand doing a lot of stuff.
Not for a little while. We didn't go to New Zealand until probably late 70s, 80s.
And then, you were actual pioneers in some of the engineering and the actual mechanics of basement construction. Like, we do basement construction, ground anchors. You probably have drilled more ground anchors than I've, You know,
we would have drilled place more ground anchors than anyone in Australia.
Yes.
Without doubt. And we're very, again, that was another, basements weren't big time up until mid to late 60s. And there was a very, E.A. Watts, you might have heard of E.A. Watts, they were the builder of Melbourne.
Yep.
They were really the only major builder. There was E.A. Watts and then Daylight Second.
Yeah.
And there was the smaller builders. But they did all the major buildings because there wasn't that much done and they were able to handle it all. E.A. Watts did not use the subcontractor system, didn't exist. They did everything. They had their own carpenters, they had their own plumbers, they had their own machinists, they had their own electricians, they had everything in-house. And their own cabinet makers and carpet layers and window glazers.
Candlestick makers and a baker down the road.
All above. That's the way the building industry was. And they were the only player. And there was a very enlightened – well, it became necessary. He was an engineer working for a building company, which is a bit unusual.
Hiring isn't just about finding someone willing to take the job. You need the right person with the right background who can move your business forward. If you want candidates who truly match what you're looking for, trust Indeed-sponsored jobs. With Indeed-sponsored jobs, your post stands out to quality candidates who actually fit the role. According to Indeed data, 90% are more likely to be hired and trusted by 1.6 million companies. Spend more time interviewing candidates who check all your boxes. Less stress, less time, more results. Now with Indeed-sponsored jobs. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to help your job get the premium status it deserves at Indeed.com/podcast13. Just go to Indeed.com/podcast13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/podcast13. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Do it the right way with Indeed.
Usual too. And I'll think of his name in a minute, but let's not worry about that. Very, very smart fellow. And they had won the contract to build the BHP building on what was the Scott's Hotel. No, it wasn't Scott's Hotel. Menzies Hotel site on the corner of William Street and Burke Street. Menzies Hotel was a very upmarket, well-to-do, where the aristocracy from the country used to come to, down to the wool sales and all that sort of thing and stay. Anyway, it was to be demolished, and what's the BHP building, which is no longer, but it was built for BHP, and it's a classical steel building, you know, the corner of William and Burke Street. I like the building. It's neat and clean and straight lines. It's with steel columns exposed and all sorts of things. And that had a sizable basement. And Hayden Phillips, his name was. I knew I'd get there, but it took me a while from E.A. Watts. Came to us because we were doing all sorts of small ground anchor jobs at this stage, and could we design this basement and all that? So we did. Employed us, but that was his foundation engineering. We still weren't geotech yet. Mm-hmm. And then there was one next door on the next corner, which was on the same corner but the opposite corner. AMP building was going to happen again with EA Watts the builder, and again we did the basement design and construction, and then this just blossomed.
I'll have to put in now. I reckon we can do a cutout now. I've got a picture from your book of all of the jobs that you've done in Melbourne CBD. There isn't a fucking street, a road, corner.
The dots.
Like, it is literally almost every building.
Yeah, and that started then. We're still doing them.
That's 20 years. That's also 15 years ago, I think you wrote your book, in 2012 or something.
2012,
you know, like every single – and you go, I'm pretty sure that's the reality. Why does the MCG need four fucking dots on it? Did you do four jobs at the MCG?
Oh, well, we've done several jobs. We did one, and there's a photo, I reckon, in my book of we did a job on the cricket pitch. The photo was there. You saw that?
Yeah.
There was discussions, you know, the pitch is too slow, it's too quick or too something. I can't remember the facts. So we were employed to go and drill holes and take soil samples and test them. To give them, and we knew nothing about how a cricket pitch should be designed. We knew how a soil could be used to put a building on. We designed the size of foundations or the type of foundations to suit that.
Yep.
But I knew nothing about soil to run a cricket pitch.
Yeah.
And between us and the staff, the ground staff of the MCG, we worked out a methodology.
Well, do the West Indies need it hard, or do they need it with
something?
I don't know either.
I don't know either, and still don't know. But they employed us to do that. But then it was there was a massive rebuilds on the MCG over the years, and we've done several jobs there over the years for additions, and the lighting towers is another thing we did the piles for. Is it six lighting towers on the MCG? I think so.
I don't know.
But there's quite a few of those big ones.
I don't know. You're the one who priced it up.
Oh, yeah, but I can't remember. Come on, give us – I'm 80 bloody seven, mate.
And so when you –
We don't buy green bananas in our house.
No, no.
We're never sure that they'll ripen.
So then you sold in 2017?
No, in 2012 the boys took over the company. Yep. They showed a fair deal of intelligence. They must have taken after their mother, so they sacked me, and then I was unemployed.
Yeah,
and I was on the streets.
You're on the streets
with a face like mine. I didn't make a lot of money on the street, I might tell you, but that's another story.
Yeah, but
so I potted about with a few interesting things that I did, and then in 2018, was it, when the Spanish came knocking at the door?
Yep.
And I still had an interest in the company at that stage. And then they came and knocked on the door, and then I got totally arsehold.
You got totally arsehold. Now, do you mind if I say the figures? Because I do know them, and it will
what
make
are
them.
The figures?
You got 188 million euros. And you
something
got
like that. I've got no idea.
And 15% or something of, like, it's all over the internet. I'm not saying anything that anyone knows.
No, well, the boys.
5,000 employees or something ridiculous.
Not then. No.
Not then.
No, we would have probably only had maybe 2.5 or 3.
Sorry.
No, there might have been more then. I don't know.
I'm so sorry. He only had 2,500 employees. How could I be so wrong?
can't remember anyway, because I was not directly involved then. But I still had a financial
You also had companies that you'd been involved or created. You had Coleman Rail.
Yeah, well, that was purchased when I was there.
Yeah, and you also had Beaver.
Yes, that was, again, I knew Beaver personally very well, and we bought his outfit. That was good. Would you have known him, because he was a sunshine boy?
No, I didn't.
Your forebears would have.
Yeah, most likely they did. My father or grandfather done a lot of work around Australia as well. They have.
Yeah, Beaver were very big in mechanical.
And then there was a geotechnical engineer, and there was a number of others, like a company made in Sydney with CDL boys, you know, to do that sort of work.
We worked together. Yeah, that's CDL were their own entity, and you'd know the CDL people probably.
Yeah, I do. Yep.
And
brilliant company.
We did all their, because they then emerged in those mid-70s, because things were booming strongly, the post-Whitlam boom, even though it slumped because of the inflationary thing, but then it reactivated again. And we had a fair bit to do with CDL, but all excavators we worked with. The Greek, the Golden Greek.
I don't know who the Golden Greek is.
The demolition company.
Oh, what, Con?
Con, it's Con Julius. we used to work for him.
Greek.
Well, that's what we used to call him.
I really like that, hey, because, like, he's another titan. He is another behemoth.
He was a great fellow, and we did all we'd work for all the excavators. And then we had a joint venture company with CDL for a little while, doing a bit of civil work, and then we outgrew each other, and that was fine. But we still do work for them; they're still operating. Yeah. They're on a smaller scale these days, CDL, I think.
Yeah, they.
But
still
I'm
do
out
some,
of it, so I'm not.
They do
speak,
some
so.
Whopping jobs still.
Do they?
You know, like they still do the 100,000 meter jobs.
Yeah.
You know, like bank meter jobs. That's a big job to get out of Melbourne. And as the traffic gets more and the infrastructure doesn't seem to keep up with our population, it seems like the jobs get harder also. And I could say some of your jobs were in beautiful open, like considerably more open, I'll say, areas.
Oh, not really, because if you look at that map you referred to of the city of Melbourne, they were all, the majority of the jobs or a large percentage of the jobs were right in the CBD.
Yeah.
So they were pretty tight.
I suppose it's a different sort of thing.
You can imagine getting trucks in and out of some of those sites wasn't easy, and you've done it probably.
Yeah. I just helped one of my mates do about 130,000 BCM in Cremorne. Yeah. And what a fucking shithole.
That's very congested. Yeah.
To get in and out of those one-way streets.
Are you in Basalt there?
Yeah, solid. Yeah. And it is.
It takes some breaking.
Didn't even break. It used to soar at the bottom.
Oh, yeah, okay.
You know, for all of the pads.
Well, they've got all this technology that, in that respect, there's been a great growth in technology. I'll bore you with this little bit of a story, because I think it's of interest and showing how things have changed. When I was working for CSIRO in 57, 58, 59, I worked for CSIRO with this bloke Parry. There were no commercial geotech companies in those days. So CSIRO was a government instrumentality. So they were used by other governments to do their soil investigation. And the CRB, as it was called, you know the CRB?
No, who is the CRB?
It's the predecessor of Vic Roads.
Okay.
You must have heard of the CRB.
Well, I have now, but not only that.
The Country Roads Board, then they changed their name to Vic Roads.
Well, now that you mention it, yes, definitely.
They did the first... A major sort of overpassy type structure was the King Street Bridge, okay, with its flyover into South Melbourne. You know the one I mean?
Yes, I do.
That the casino is now enclosed inside itself. But in those days, the casino didn't exist, as you'd be aware of that.
You did the job for the casino, so I believe, as well.
We did that as well. Mm. But we did the CRB job by CSIRO. So we got a driller was employed. And we took the samples. We didn't have a drilling entity, CSIRO. We just had laboratories and soil engineers, and we could design, take the samples, test the samples and design the footings accordingly, right?
Yes.
So we did all that, and the drilling company, it was drilling the holes and taking the samples, and I spent all the time on the drill rigs, taking the samples, supervising and taking the logs and checking when to stop the hole, when to continue it, all this stuff, under my boss's instructions. Mm-hmm. And the CSIRO had their labs at Melbourne University in those days. So I'd take the samples up there and we'd test them and da-di-da-di-da. And then when the Utah Constructions, who had been working in the Snowy, and you might have heard of Utah Constructions, you may not have,
no,
but they were quite big in those days, and they come out of the Snowy, and you know the history of the Snowy Mountains, and they were finishing up there and they were bidding civil work around Australia. They didn't last all that long, but they did the King Street Bridge. And then I was on site during the construction of the piles and supervising them from the laboratory testing we'd done and the design we'd done to make sure it was still similar ground and the foundation where they'd stopped the pile and all this sort of stuff, which is logical enough.
Mm-hmm.
And they were able, taking 2 weeks, to do a pile, a 5-foot diameter steel pile. It's 100 feet of soft silts there down onto mudstone.
Mm-hmm.
They had to get down 100 feet.
It's a real solid mudstone down the bottom, though, isn't it?
Yeah. But you got 100 feet of soft silt.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why there were no significant buildings in that area in those days. There's now heaps, and we've done most of their foundations.
Mm-hmm.
They would take 2 weeks to put in one pile.
What?
With the machine.
In 2 weeks?
Yeah. That's the machinery we had in the 1950s.
That's a good point.
That's the reality.
I think that now they're doing...
But we didn't have these clever things. We didn't have... Excavators didn't exist, mate.
So CFA rig can go down around 30, 35 at the moment.
Oh, no, 100.
100?
Yeah.
100 metres?
Correct. With no need to, because in Melbourne you would never go that deep.
Maybe it's just the big ones I know that are 35 metres, because that's what they drilled down to.
The ones got will go 100 metres. And they... But you have no need to go that deep here. But with CFAs, we'd do 10 in a day.
Yeah.
And so that's the difference. 2 weeks to do it with the machine they had then, which was called a Benoto, B-E-N-O-T-O. It was a French-type name, I believe. And it was a casing oscillator, which I think I even read about it, wrote in my book.
Yep.
They'd oscillate the casing, then they'd grab the stuff out of the centre with the cloverleaf grab. And I think I had a photo of that too. So that's how it... And it'd fall down under gravity as it oscillated.
Absolutely.
And then
ridiculous.
They'd weld on the next
where
bit.
Where now you just drive your rig there, turn
but
and
another, your kids and grandkids, they'll be pushing a button from the desk and it'll be happening.
Yeah.
You can't even envisage how it'll be.
No, definitely not.
AI will be designing the bloody thing. Ooh. And building it.
So how do...
So these are... my lifetime, the changes have... give you a little bit of an example. When I was on the farm, we could, with horses pulling a header, you know what a header is?
Mm-hmm.
We could do 30 acres a day. Now my nephew is a farmer. He does 300 acres a day with a 50-foot header. We had a 10-foot header.
Yep, yeah.
And that's... It's the same in any game.
So how do you, as a business, because you've gone through a lot of generations, like from an oscillating to a CFA to, you know, small CFAs, big ones, anchor rigs, you name it. How do you, like say me as a business, I've been going 15 years or, you know, seriously 15 years. How do I stay ahead of the game? How does someone else stay ahead of the game? As A, it's moving so fucking fast. Like everything moves so fast.
Oh, well, you just got to keep up with it. But you've got information here incessantly.
Yes.
It's in your face all the time.
How do you go from an old Bedford to a nice Kenworth?
Look, your grandfather would have. He'd have gone from a wagon to a bloody Bedford and thought the world was his oyster.
Yeah, with a TK and then Bedford and a Joey box two handles.
Exactly.
He can't actually believe that you drive an 18-speed road Ranger.
I mentioned to you earlier when I was at Mount Newman, my nearest telephone was 500 or 350 miles, 500K. So to make a phone call, I had to drive 1,000K on a dirt road.
Now I can't get people to keep the phone out of their hand.
I know. They're born with them attached, aren't they?
It reminds me of the story.
We did have the Flying Doctor radio for emergency use when I was in that camp. Because the Flying Doctor radio, and you've heard of it?
Yes.
Still exists in parts of Australia.
And it's fantastic. It's been a service for a long time.
Anyway, they used to also take telegrams as a service. So when they had skeds every twice a day, 8 o'clock in the morning, no, it's 9 o'clock, 9 o'clock in the morning or 4 o'clock in the afternoon, they had scheduled services online for the people in the bush. Generally station owners and mining companies were starting to emerge and come into the thing, and you could report. They'd do medical calls first. They'd have a doctor online on the two-way radio, and you can imagine two-way radio quality in those days was pretty basic, and sort of thing.
And you've got to say that Jeff's just had his leg cut off.
Exactly.
And you need someone to help.
And what was that? He said, you've broken the leg off your chair. and seriously, it was very poor quality. You can understand that. The distance was vast. Anyway, I had all these blokes in the camp, and through the middle of between Mount Newman and Port Hedland, where the railway line was going for the Mount Newman ore, and all this stuff, and we're working on the mine and the railway line testing to make sure all the ground, the bridge crossings and everything we had to test. And there was the Fortescue River, which consisted of a bed of sand about 100 metres wide 99% of the time. And then when a cyclone tail end or something had come by, it became a raging torrent for a week or two or three and so forth. So I this time the Fortescue got flooded, and I sent a telegram over the Flying Doctor. I would read it out to them. They'd take it, and they'd get on their bike and ride down to the post office in Port Hedland, send the telegram. Do you know what a telegram is? You probably don't.
Yeah.
And then if a telegram came back, they would pick up from the office the telegrams, because we had our address was 8WOH Outpost Radio. So they'd get our number, and then they'd read it out. We had telegrams for da-di-da and da-di-da and da-di-da. So we'd sit around waiting for a telegram to be read out. The whole world heard these telegrams. Anyway, this day I sent off a telegram. The Fortescue got flooded and we couldn't get out. We were isolated. And those telegrams you paid per word. It's a bit like texting. We developed
shorthand,
and you'd keep it to a minimum words, as texting does. And you'd abbreviate words, not as clever as texting, but it was similar in principle.
Mm.
So I sent this telegram, and you'd keep it minimal because the translation between me telling the Flying Doctor man, he'd writing it down, getting his bloke to ride on his bike down to Port Hedland.
Want a game of Chinese whispers.
Exactly. So I said, Fortescue flooded, urgently required two punts and a canoe. And I got a telegram back the next day, the girls are on the way, but what the hell's a canoe?
That's actually quite good.
It is. It's true. So anyway, that why did I get onto that subject?
I don't know.
It's all your fault.
I don't know. I think I'm going to find out what a panoo is.
So you can imagine that in the geotech lectionary today, panoo is what we call a panoo, and it's been called that for about 60, 70 years.
Oh, that's funny. So something I want to touch on briefly that you brought up with mining, because you've done so much work, is recently you actually had an old video of yours emerge from 15 years ago where you're pretty happy you were in Sweden.
Correct.
Because I actually know your daughter fairly well. I work with her, and so I was talking to her about it. So 15 years ago, you're in Sweden. They took you over there for an electric drill rig to show you that didn't work all
day. No, it wasn't a drill rig. It was a miner, a mining machine, a continuous miner that Atlas Copco had developed, and we'd...
So a surface miner? Is
No, underground miner.
An underground miner.
And it was like a mini roadheader. Do you know what a roadheader is?
Yeah, I know exactly what it is now.
Small because when in underground mining, which I do a lot of work in now, me and a mate, that fellow that was in that picture, Sam, he used to work with Geotech. He'd worked 2 or 3 years back when I was still working with the company, and I'd met him and done a couple of jobs. He'd worked on a couple of jobs that I was involved in, and I got to know him, and he came to me one day and he said, I've been offered a job with Rio. And I said, yeah, well, what's the problem? And in those days, well, still today, the mining companies and all the construction companies, the consulting engineers and the geologists and everybody, they and scientists and everybody goes around to the universities in their final year and talks to the students and say, we've got work opportunities here, here or here. You know what it's about.
Yep.
And he filled out a form for several of them, and one of them was for Rio, saying, yeah, I'd be interested in getting a job with you. He did civil engineering at Monash. Anyway, 2 years later, he got a response. There's a job for you in North Parks, which is northern New South Wales.
Yeah.
At Rio.
Parks and Forbes.
Yeah, in that region.
Yeah, that area.
It's called North Parks. I think it's a town called North Parks, but I'm not sure. Anyway, executive training program, or words to that effect. And that's fine. And he came to me and he said, I've been offered this job. And I said, I don't like to leave, but you've been good to me. You're giving me a job, da-di-da-di-di. And I said, what are they offering you? I said, 150 grand, and he was on about 100 with us. So I said, there's no point in waiting around here, mate. Grab it, because you'll end up back here, because it always happens. Every bastard comes back. We're an old people's home at Geotech.
Yep.
And... It's anyway, to make a long story short, he went off. And after 2 years working there, they put him underground, and he'd never been underground in his life. Hadn't even been on a fucking train in the Melbourne Underground, probably. But anyway, be that as it may. And he enjoyed it immensely. But he went to his boss one day and he said, look, what's this executive training program I'm supposed to be in? And the bloke said, what are you talking about? He said, well, here, I'm supposed to be doing this, this and this, the bullshit that you gave me when I started. He said, get back underground.
Yeah, running a roadheader, mate. Yeah. Get under there.
Basically what he was doing was a labourer, but it was great experience for him. So he started looking around for other jobs, and then he got a job with a nickel company in South Australia, in Western Australia, a Russian nickel company, who then closed down because nickel price collapsed, and he was with them for a couple of years. Then he went to Rosebery in Tasmania. So he's quite experienced at this stage, and he was underground manager at Rosebery, and he had this problem with when you do a drilling in underground mining, they sink a shaft, put drives off the shaft to the ore body, then drill holes up in the ore body, charge it, blast it, and it falls down, and gravity does half earth, and they bog it out. Exactly. So, but when you're drilling these up holes and you're drilling through different geology, hard and soft layers, sometimes the drill rods snap, and if you've ever drilled a hole in your wall in a hard brick to put a bloody picture hook in or something, sometimes they'll snap, because when you make steel very hard, it also gets very brittle, as I'm sure you're aware. So this was happening, and there was problems with the safety angle, because the rods would break off and you might leave 20 metres of drill rod in the hole that may weigh 500 or 600 kgs, and that could, they couldn't get them out.
That's a bad day and if then, that falls down at the wrong
time.
Well,
it did. It happened often. Because you'd be blasting another section of the mine and it could fall out.
Of course, it'll rattle
so,
it.
And so make the rules become very clear very quickly. You can't work in that area until you make that hole safe. And this generally meant they tried putting plates over, but the forces were too massive. They were just blowing the plates off. And then they'd pump it full of cement and all sorts of things, which they wasted.
Yeah, but now you...
They wasted 2 days. And then I made that little gizmo that you heard about, the plug we made. So that's that's what we designed. And Sam came to me.
I like how you describe it as a gizmo. Like that's...
It's just like a bloody wall plug or a bloody dynabolt, isn't it? But no one had thought of it.
Yeah, pretty much. And but you pretty much made it so that they could keep working in multiple mines around Australia.
They can put this back in 5 minutes and just keep going.
Mm.
And it's accepted.
Yeah, accepted practice.
Practice. And we started our little entity and then we sort of started getting questioned about doing this, can we do that, can we do this sort of thing, and that's human nature, as you'd know. That's how we grew from starters and how you grew from starters. Mm-hmm. And you always say yes and da-da-da-da-da.
Can't say no, not once.
No. You always say I can do anything because you're talking to a bloke who knows a little less than you or maybe he knows more, but I've got more bullshit than the other. So anyway, we showed interest. Atlas Copco came to us and I know them well and they know us. We buy a lot of gear from them, as you'd be aware of that probably. Mm-hmm. And we caught up with them in our travels with this plug thing and different things, because they're big in underground mining, and they told us about this continuous miner. And we started taking a lot of interest. And I thought, shit, this has got a good idea. It's got great...
This has got some legs, this great, one.
This has got real legs. Because what at the moment we do, we go in, we drill holes, we've got about a 5 metre wide by 4 metre high thing, so you've got to have a small machine, relatively small, to go in there. And so you drill your holes, you charge your holes, you blast it, and then you get a bogger in and take it out, and you can do it only about 3 metre runs at a time. So it's a pretty tedious process. Mm. And after you blast it, you've got to wait a certain time for the air to clear and all this sort of before you can go back. So this seemed to have great concept.
Yeah, so it turns into it turns the blasting and everything into a grinder.
So it just cuts it out like a TBM or any of those machines.
It's got a cutter.
It's a mini TBM.
And it's got a conveyor belt on the back of it. That
takes it out, it bogs it and everything.
Yep.
So it's continuous. It's continuous. You just keep adding conveyors on, you put trucks on the other end of it or whatever you like. So it's a hell of an improvement. So they said, yeah, we'll be this little way away perfecting it, but we're getting there and we're talking to interested people and we're very interested because Sam and I were going to get one of these and go contract mining because most of the mining is done by contract.
Yep.
By subbies like the construction industry is.
Yep.
So we thought we could get into this. And so we go over to and then about 12 months later they tell us we're having this big display in our works in Sweden. So off we go over to Sweden. And as along with people from America and Canada and Africa and Christ knows any mining country is all represented there. Everyone's interested in it.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we go there and we're there getting buggered about and buggered about and buggered about, and then they start showing us these electrical trucks and electrical this and electrical that, and we're not really interested in that shit.
No.
And they tell us at 3 o'clock this afternoon, the afternoon of the first day we're there, that the machine doesn't work. So we've come all this way and wasted all this money. It's cost us 20 grand and wasted 2 weeks' work for nothing.
And then a reporter puts a microphone under
yourself.
Well,
it wasn't a reporter. It was one of their staff, a PR person.
Bullshit. It was actually someone
with
from...
a girl in...
You can't see her
around
on the video.
No, well, you can't see her on the video because she was obviously taking the video. And she asked us what we thought of the display and everything, this display they put on to sell this product.
Yeah.
I said it was a fucking non-event. I wasn't a happy camper. So I was in the frame of mind to sort of tell them to stick it up their jumper. Yeah. And she told us how we're going to save the planet with all this electricity. I said, well, you've got your hand in your pyjamas. Like, so you've heard the rest of it. So that's how it happened.
And now, but 15
years
later.
And that machine has never, ever started.
Really?
No, they've never developed it any further. They couldn't get it to work the day we went over there. You can imagine the Yanks and the bloody Canadians and the South Americans were not amused either.
No, definitely not. And so, but since then, there has been some real big leaps.
There hasn't been. They're still mining exactly the same.
Are they really?
Which staggers me because, you know, Roadheaders then come into being. mm-hmm. and so forth. Well, this was really one of the early radiators in retrospect, but it was mm-hmm. smaller because it had to work in a small 5 metres by 4 metres maximum space, so it had to be considerably smaller than that to work in there.
They're doing sections of North East Link and Metro Tunnel with road headers?
They are using it very widely in construction, but not in mining.
Not in mining.
And sorry, I may have misled you there.
Interesting.
And they've never developed this any further. I've still got all the information on it.
They're going. They're going. So a lot of not underground mining, but like surface big cut jobs. They're doing electric.
Oh yes, of course they are. You know, and that's got nothing to do with it. I was just pissed off. We went over there. We didn't go to look at electrical shit. Couldn't give a monkeys.
Definitely not.
We went to look at this machine.
Electrical's just really hard anyway. Like I went, so I got my block of lands down here where I park everything, and I went for a job that needs some electric trucks because of whatever it is. If it, you know, and so I priced up to upgrade my amps. You know, that I needed. And so I rung my mate. He runs an electrical company, very successful, you know, and I said, listen, I need to upgrade my amps or volts or whatever.
What, your supplier to your factory?
The supplier to
your
factory.
Yard so you can charge your batteries.
Yeah, and he looked at it, rung me back, and he goes, you're putting a Westfield there. And I said, what? And he goes, a Westfield, a shopping centre. Yeah. You're upgrading to have a shopping centre.
Well, yeah, but you'd use, that'd be what charging capacity in there.
Yeah, so exactly. It's like 400 amps or something for, you know, a regular factory, even one that's doing cold stores, 1 to 200 amps. And this was double so that it could fast charge 4 trucks.
Yeah, sure.
And you just sit there and you go, like, I get it. Or like, I understand electricity is great. Fantastic. To do it from a sustainable way is also great. But, man, like 400 amps, it was going to be $1 million to upgrade. But like, diesel Bowser there already that's delivered by a really great guy called John every 2 days, fills up my diesel Bowser, and then $1 million to upgrade the infrastructure, let alone to actually get that.
But this will happen in time.
Do you think so?
Oh, it has to. It will improve, and there's nothing sure. But you know, the initial
you
jolt's
think
a bit
that
of a
there's
jolt.
Nothing sure because I'm not actually sure. I think
read in the paper. Look, I reckon I read 3 months ago, and shows you how things can rapidly change. How many electric cars have been sold and all this sort of thing. I read in this morning's paper, which I only read briefly this morning, saying that the BYDs are selling for nothing in China now because they can't sell the bloody thing. So 3 months ago they were selling hundreds.
And they can't
of them.
Transport them. Did you see that
no,
the biggest
I didn't see
transporter,
that.
Because of the fires that have happened recently.
Oh, with the batteries.
One of the biggest transporters pulled out of transporting around
really?
EVs.
No, I didn't see that.
Yeah.
So everything's got its issues. Nothing's as simple and magic as it might appear at first glance. But
maybe there is that.
Human nature will get it right. Don't argue. Don't give
but,
up.
But maybe
look at the
not
changes we've just talked about here in my lifetime and even in your lifetime.
But it might not be electrical.
Well, it might
be could
something
be.
Magic.
It could be something completely separate.
Where Twiggy was going to play bugger and get green hydrogen, but that never happened.
Well,
green
steel.
That we, you and I, and you particularly, because you've made a lot more money than I have.
I somehow think that's very untrue.
You gave a lot of
even
money.
Even Louis laughing in the corner.
you gave a lot of
those numbers before, Louis. Like you almost sat down when I said that he didn't have 5,000. He only had 3. All right, just pull on back.
What was I talking about before you really sidetracked me?
green
steel was going to happen, but now it's not, and because it was going to cost more energy to get to make the hydrogen.
Well, everyone can still read.
They're going to save by the other end. So.
Everyone can still read, and I know you might not want to get into it too much because I also don't, because I do a bit of work on them. But you know, everyone's read about the wind farms and everything that cost more energy and more carbon to build than they.
So
they
do the
save.
Solar panels on your roof,
and so do the solar panels. But overall, you can have some benefits to them.
Oh,
I'm not saying
they will. Science will get it, mate. It always has.
The first
motor cars you read, I remember reading about this in history books, when the first motor cars went on the roads, the fella had to walk in front of the car with a red flag to warn people they were coming.
Yeah, because you couldn't hear it.
Yeah, and supposedly. So these are – this is life. It's going to emerge. But the green hydrogen thing didn't work. But someone will come around and get it to work or get something similar to work.
Yes.
It's inevitable.
I think that like the, our grid and actually our infrastructure of what we have, it hasn't been built like for electricity. It hasn't been
built. For feedback. It's only been built from coming from the power station to the source. Hasn't been built from going back. But that's changing now. There's major contracts out there for building new whole new distribution centres that'll take traffic both ways, and that's life. And what we build today in another 30 years will have to be built again.
Did you hear about the Amazon putting in for in Truganina, I think it was, down here? And I could be dead wrong, and I get told I'm wrong often on these things. Because
I can't believe a word of that.
Yes, some guy will be like, no, you are a dickhead, you know.
Well, they're pretty right at that, but that's another story.
But Amazon were looking to put in their own small power station in Truganina to run their data centre. Because that's how much power
they
draw.
Apparently, data centres, I didn't understand this. They're very big uses of power,
Incredible uses of power. So now, like, but our grid that's, like, we've still got transmission towers that were built by, my grandpa was digging some of the foundations for them 60, 70 years ago. The cables are still the cables.
Of course they are.
How do we change that? Like, what are we going to do to be able to have, you know?
Well, they're just, there's massive contracts being out now to rebuild the grid system. But, of course, they can't do anything because you get the farmers saying you can't build them and then the council saying you can't put it across.
I talk about not in my backyard. Well, exactly. So I want a fucking quarry down the road so I get cheap rock.
Exactly.
But I don't want it next door to me.
Speaking of that, do you know anything about quarries and all that?
I do know a little bit about quarries,
I'll talk to you about that one day too, because I've got a quarry that I want to develop, but I'll worry about that another day.
But we cut that bit out? Because people will be crawling up you to, you know, quarry to develop. Are you an angel?
An angel?
You might be my one.
What's an angel?
An angel is someone that looks after, like a guardian angel to me, like sit down and offer me to, you know, the smallest little morsel of a quarry to, actually in saying that though, a month ago a guy calls me up and he goes, listen, I've got to fill a quarry.
Yeah.
And I say, when do you want me? Where do you want me? Because I'm there. And then I drive up there 2 hours to get there, because it doesn't really matter where the quarry is because you can do some. And then he said, I was an hour early just in case, sent him a text half an hour before I was meant to be there letting him know I was there. And then 10 minutes later he rocks up. I rock up to this quarry and it's him taking, you know, 200, 300 cubic metres of gravel out of an old riverbed, and that was it, and that's what he wanted me to fill. I'm thinking she's a hole, you know, in the ground. Like, we truck a bit of dirt, not as much as, you know, some of the jobs out there, but we truck a little bit of dirt. We probably truck, you know, 100,000 a week on something in a busy week, somewhere around there, 20,000 loose cubic metres a day, which is enough to cause us a little bit of drama.
Yeah.
Especially trying to move it from the city these days, where it's a 3 or 4 load day instead of, even when I started, it was a 7 load day or 6.
Yeah, well, you can't. Well, you don't have to tell anyone in any big city these days. I went up to on Friday to a funeral in Bacchus Marsh, and I hadn't been along Ballarat Road to Melton and Bacchus Marsh for a long time.
My gosh.
I mean, bloody Melton is a city in itself these days and expanding rapidly every day. And that's just one example.
But there's suburbs you've never even heard of, like in a million. And you go there and we went and did all of the bulk earthworks for a school. But it's a whole school. It's not like they're tacking on a building. Like, it's like, we need a new school. Here's the planning permit. Here's this.
And where was that? In Truganina or one of those names?
Strathulla.
Never heard of it. Where's that?
In between Truganina and Melton.
Okay, yeah.
Strathulla. You go out there, they've built a housing estate like this around it. Okay. In the middle, they've got, you know, 20,000 square metres of grass. Yeah. I need to strip it 100 different levels. I need compaction here. I need a subgrade, like all of this. And I need it done in a month. And you go, I don't know how, like... Oh, but then all of a sudden you get it done in 3.5 weeks and it seems to be that works pretty good and you made a bit of money. It's only when it's on the flip side of that it takes you 2 months and you look like a dickhead that all of
us... But this is the way we're developing. But I think we're going to... more Welton put more services in, and this is going to happen. This is inevitable. Schools are going to get more needs for medical centres, hospitals. I mean, look at... I drove past Sunshine Hospital coming back the other day from Ballarat, from Bacchus Marsh on the Western Ring Road. And it's got scaffold over, they're extending that. Is the Footscray Hospital open yet? Has to be the biggest footprint hospital in the world.
Yeah, no, it's...
must be imminent.
It's got to be coming close, but no, I don't believe it is.
No, nor
it
do might I. Have no, some no one things seems open. To know.
But no, they might have some because... no, it's definitely not. I was there the other day and I'm pretty sure that...
But it's a massive...
It is site. Fucking ridiculous.
And this is indicative of the... but the people in that area are going to have sick people.
I think that
people.
Was a half...
You've got to consider us poor old pricks. We need help, mate.
500,000 metres that hole was that
I've got
Con
no idea,
did.
But, yeah. But it was a big... It is a big footprint.
Huge.
Of the site.
But it's also not... It's not, like usually big footprint means, you know, four levels or five levels.
Six or eight levels, isn't it? It's quite high. Yeah.
It's now...
So it's a massive hospital and... that's the needs that we demand. We all call for all these things. They're keeping us old farts alive longer.
That they are, definitely.
And I'm nearly 88 and I should be dead, but I'm going to defy you pricks and keep alive and making a prick of myself.
Yeah, but it's...
Very difficult for me to do that.
But only buy yellow bananas. You want more, five more? I reckon we go 10 more for this one. We do about an hour to not keep everyone... we keep them engaged in it.
Oh, yeah, it's a bit like the definition of dancing. Do you know what the definition of dancing is?
No.
It's a naval engagement without loss of semen. So that's quite clever, isn't it?
That is quite clever.
That's very witty, whoever thought that.
I've never been good at dancing.
Ballroom dancing was our total recreation.
Yeah.
I was a young fellow. So we did.
And so what year were you born? So if 87, 38. Okay, so, yeah, but I've seen some movies from back then.
Oh, yeah, that was our total.
You still had a wind-up television that came out in the 50s, wasn't it?
We had a kerosene TV.
Kerosene TV, yeah, you had to light it to get it to go.
Yeah. We didn't have a TV for many years and they were incredibly expensive relative to wages.
Yeah.
They were about $1,000 and wages were probably a quarter or a tenth of what we're getting today. My first job, I was getting £8 a week.
For a full-time job?
Yeah, as an engineer with CSIRO.
My first job, I made chicken in a chicken shop. I got $5 an hour or $4.90 an hour when I was 14. And I thought that I was king of the canteen.
That's $200 a week.
No, I was only working Thursday nights and Saturdays.
Oh, yeah, but you're talking hour. But on a 40-hour week basis, that's $200 a week.
Yeah,
and I was getting £8, which is $16.
Yeah.
And I had a degree in engineering. But that's by the by. It's just the way life was.
And I was making schnitzel with a hammer.
Yeah, belting the shit out of it.
Belting the shit, but the richest kid in the tuck shop line. I could buy as many potato cakes as you wanted, you know.
Yeah.
Or 4 and 20 pies, the shepherd's pie, or a pasty as well.
Exactly.
But the pasty would sell out pretty quick. There was never enough, which was a pain.
Well, that's the way of the world. But it's how do we get onto this subject?
I don't know, because I like pasties.
Well, I've been trying for 87 years to find something I don't like and I've been singularly unsuccessful.
Really?
Yeah. There's no food I don't like.
Not
as
one.
As you can tell by looking at me.
Yeah, but that's okay. I don't. I eat everything. I don't love olives. So there you go.
I don't love olives, but I can eat them.
Mm.
No, I can eat olives quite well. And when first, you know, using oils, olive oil and things like that in salads, I wasn't that keen, but now it's a fact of life today. So, you know, we changed slowly, I suppose, over the years of the post-war migration. We introduced us to all the new foods and things.
So the last thing I'd wanted to talk about is you actually named your book Make Your Hobby Your Job.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually a thing that isn't spoken about enough these days.
I never went to work.
No, but you also probably worked a bit more than 40 or 50 hours a week.
Oh, yeah, but that was life. It was, and you do too.
Yeah, but do you think that's actually a reason of, you know, these, I don't want to say, like, you have people these days that are talking about work-life balance and stuff like that, but it's just my life for me, you know. Well, like, kids were here this morning for me we're here on a Sunday, and kids are just with dad, you know, playing around the office and running away.
My kids were the same. And I said in my book, I got three boys and three girls. And the girls used to say, including Simone and Mary and Naomi, the other one, the only time we had holidays is when Dad was building a dam in outback Western Australia or something, and we'd drive there, and they were bored shitless.
You have well-rounded, healthy kids?
Well, I think they're well-rounded and healthy.
See?
But it's part of your life. And growing up on a farm, you're part of the whole thing. My job in the morning when I was on the farm, I used to have to get up and milk two or three cows depending on the season, two minimum, three maximum, separate the milk. You know what separating the milk is?
Yep.
It's feeding the skim milk to the pigs and the chooks and the other lambs and things we had, and then washing the separator, and then going have breakfast, and then I'd ride my horse to school. And then when my sister's younger sister, this is I was only 8 years old, I'd drive a horse and gig and take my younger sisters to school, and that was typical of farming. And you but did isn't it. And I'd come home and do the same thing.
But now kids, you can't get them off of a fucking iPad half probably of not. The time, yeah. You know, and then they wonder why the work or their work-life balance or whatever isn't necessarily
well,
what
I,
they...
I hear what you're saying, but it was an adventure for me. I had a Meccano set as a kid, and it was probably quite a small set relative to, do you know what a Meccano set is?
Yeah. Yep.
And I used to make, all I knew was farm implements. I didn't know, and trains. There was a train ran through the village that I lived nearby, 3 miles away. And that was probably the biggest thing that I knew as a kid. And then I played with that, and I've had a Meccano set for the rest of my life to play with. It's been an adventure, and it's been a game. And I heard Rolf Harris being interviewed, and that's what I said in my book in the last few pages, why I thought that term was quite good. And what I've done, and you're aware of it, it's interesting what you're doing. Same thing, isn't it? Don't you think?
I like think digging holes. I like trucking dirt. I like the art of the deal. I like the you know,
getting you're like Mr. Trump. You like the art of the deal.
Getting your brain together. No, I don't. You know what? 2 years ago or something, I was a bit more of a fan of Mr. Trump, but then lately he's came
a bit of
on.
A disappointment,
and,
isn't he?
And he's came on.
We won't
on.
Go into him. We'll waste, waste
our
time.
And I thought he was going to change something in politics compared to what he's actually done. And he's just been pretty much exactly the same, just on the different side of the coin.
A bit disappointing. Well, one of the problems that I find so disappointing in Australia, in our politics, and I'm not knocking the politicians at all, is the 3 year term. It's ridiculous. You're in business, you can't plan 3 years, you've got to look further ahead.
Yeah, but are
the most important business in Australia is running the government. Give them 5 years, get them to do some
long. I think it's got a different problem than that altogether. I think that they've ended up being incentivised to buy the votes rather than to do what's good for Australia.
Well, I think it's only human nature, they're going to try and protect their jobs and so forth. But
do you think that that's the same through your lifetime? Because I know that there was some real patriotic leaders that we had.
Yeah, well, you know. I never knew them personally, and I don't know any now personally. But our opinion is formed by the press and the television where they're continuously exposed to us. How do you judge them? But I think they're very well-intentioned. I've had a bit to do with politicians, of course, and I think they're generally well-intentioned, sometimes a bit misdirected. But they're pretty honest, I think. I reckon I've only met two or three dishonest people in my life, real rogues. I think the general person is pretty decent, and I've got no grizzles and bitches about that. But I just think Australia could be a better country with a 5-year federal government. State governments don't matter much.
A bit more now.
Well, but it's still Fed governments are the most important. We have a 4-year term for our states.
Yes.
So which makes a mockery of the feds at three.
I've never understood the levels of, we have local, state and federal for what seems to be, it creates us a fairly bureaucratic, heavy society.
It does. But you've got to have bureaucracies. You've got to have organisations. I mean, people can say... and when I used to think similarly, one of my early jobs I got in the early 50s when I was working for the previous company, Foundation Engineering, was for BHP at the Newcastle Steelworks. They'd had a problem there with it's built on the, if you might know, the steelworks in Newcastle, but it's at a port, of course, and it's on the ocean,
mm-hmm.
The Hunter River actually runs through Newcastle, but it's a tidal river because the sea comes in and out there, as you know. And the piles had all rotted away; they were all timber-driven piles, and they had this gap in the water. The tidal zone of timber, it rots. If it's totally covered with water, it doesn't rot. And if it's totally in air, it remains good.
Yep.
But it's in the zone where the tide goes up and down that it rots away. And so we had to cut those bits of piles out and put new bits in, concrete bits in.
Easy job.
It was an easy job. But it's a quid at the end. But the point I'm trying to make is we used to always laugh about bureaucracies and how complex and this thing. Went to BHP and I'd have been, 22 or 3 or something, a young, knew everything engineer sort of thing. Took me 3 days to get in the bloody front gate. They're a big company, they had developed a government-like bureaucracy.
Now once I think it takes you a month to get in the gate at BHP.
Exactly. And this is because when you get a big organisation, and there's no bigger organisation than government of the country, a bureaucracy has to be. And BHP was the first time I'd experienced it in private enterprises, we'd call it. So it's just a product of growth into big entities. And you go to any big company and you've got the same bloody thing.
How do you make that more efficient though? Because obviously
the smarter people than I tried to work on that and they haven't succeeded. No, seriously.
Of course.
You've got to have the support services to the workers in the coalface, you know that.
But as you rise up, you need to make sure that you're not too top heavy. So,
I know. One of the great things that a great saying of my mother, and we use the word very, very often, and I'm sure you do too, and I'll never forget my mother saying, common sense is badly named. It's most uncommon. How true is that? You meet some fuckwits in your lifetime. They wouldn't know shit from clay, and it's not that hard to make a quid in this. If a dumb old bastard like me can make a quid, it's not that hard.
I think that I'm going to clip the shit out of that last little bit and, common sense is actually uncommon and there's fuckwits out
Common sense is badly named as most uncommon.
It absolutely
is. It's true, and you've met them. And bureaucracies are there to protect and to protect the rest of the world. It's very difficult.
How did you go, though, watching your company become that? Because your company did as well. So your company, when you started...
Well, I suppose... We'll kid ourselves, it's human nature, that we are more efficient than others.
Oh, is that what it is?
Ever have a true look at ourselves? I don't know. But we do get, there's more and more red tape, for example, and not unjustifiably so, safety requirements. I mean, shit, some of the things we did in the old days, you're not allowed to do now, of course. That thing that I made for saving the rods. No one worried about killing people once, but now, I took that example of that rod falling out of the thing. Went to a mining conference in Russia, not that many years ago, 7 or 8 years ago, can't remember when. And at the conference there, and I had paid for stall,
Look at us go, we've got.
And this Russian bloke comes up to me, and his English is pretty good, and he said, "What's this?" And I said, "He said, "What do you do with this? What's the point?" He said, "I said, but the thing calls out and kills someone." He says, "Who gives a fuck?" He said, "Seriously."
And you go, "I don't think there's much of a market here."
I said. Took me a little while to make that decision. 2 seconds.
Well, I reckon we could just pack up, eh?
That's in Australia, as you would know, and they're all Western countries, and you wouldn't even try and sell it in South America or Africa for the very same reasons.
Yeah.
But that's life, mate. And I think our bureaucracy educates our people better, it keeps our health better, it saves lives and all these things.
And I'm all for that.
And that's what happens. We get more and more bureaucrats, the more and more we develop. It's just
Is the per capita bureaucrat going up as well as just the sheer volume?
I think it does a little bit, yes, because of better safety procedures come in and better environmental is big time today.
We discussed on the way in that, you used to have the Board of Works, you used to have the councils taking care of everything, running the tip sites and everything else. Yeah. They probably have more bureaucrats in the local council offices than they did running everything.
Mrs. Jones, the ratepayer, comes in and says to the Shire Engineer or the City municipal engineer, whatever it is. Oh, why is the road outside my house broken down? And why is this happening here? And da-di-da-di-did. And this is common. You read it in the press every day. So we are more demanding. So I think we've got to be a bit more understanding of these things. And look, the way I look at life, a lot of the work that I did, in we've done in our geotech career and probably still doing, is probably a bit on the 120% safety angle, you know. You wonder, really, do the world need this? Is it going to benefit society? Well, it might save a life or two, but it may not. You know what I'm trying to say?
Oh, definitely.
And people will keep coming up with ideas. So governments have real responsibilities, local government at that level and state government. So it's I wouldn't be caring to bell the cat, if you know what I'm trying to say. You know what the story about belling the cat?
No, but I want you to tell it right here because I actually
well,
like
how
you
put this. Well, the mice decided they had this meeting of the mices.
The meeting of the mices. The
mices and said, this is a bit silly. The bloody cat's knocking us off and we can't have this because he's eating me and my brothers and sisters and mum and dad and it's a bit rough. So they decided that they'd have a council of war. So all the mice met in Parliament and decided they'd put a bell on the cat so that the cat, when he was walking around, the bell would ring and they'd be warned and be able to run away and hide. But then the big question was, who's going to bell the cat?
Who does bell the cat?
Exactly. Yeah. So that's what life comes down to. You've heard that term presumably, but that's how it arranged. The mice man told, I know that, so it got it straight from the mouse's mouth. That's how belling the cat came in. Do you, when I was a kid on the farm, we used to put bells on the horses and they'd roam free of the paddock sometimes and you'd be able to find them because you'd hear the bells clanging. That's true. And the drovers used to do that when they're driving sheep and cattle in the outback. That's fact. You'd bell the horses.
Bell the cattle. It's a lot easier for a drover to bell a horse than it is a mouse to bell.
Well, yeah, I'd never heard that they got over that problem, but the committee decided it was a good idea to bell the cat. They'd hear it coming, but who was going to bell the cat? That was the next problem.
Jerry Noonan, thank you very much for coming. I appreciate your time.
Well, thank you for your patience and putting up with an old pensioner who's had a bit of fun in his life and still having fun.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Yeah, right.
Thank you. No.